I'm up on a tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is going to be, frankly, one of the most productive and disciplined writers I know, Jose de Pierola. And if that name doesn't sound familiar to you, it's maybe because you don't read Peruvian literature. He is a writer from Peru, and he has many, many books out, all of them published in Peru, and all of them just incredibly fascinating. You're gonna really like talking to him. He's also a professor here in the bilingual MFA in creative writing. You know, I've known him for years, and I think about his discipline, and I remember that after grad school, I got a job at Modesto Junior College teaching a full load of composition and pre-composition classes. And I knew that writers who take jobs like that often quit writing because you have to grade 1,000 essays a week. I was determined that I would continue to be a writer. I would wake up every morning and write a couple of hours before I went to school. And I was working on a novel called St. Martin in the Fields, a play called Speak Through the Wind, and a story collection called Chicano Chicanery. But after 2 years of teaching at the community college, I hadn't finished a thing. And the thing about writing fiction is every time you enter into the landscape, the one that you're creating, you linger there and you begin to understand the world and the characters and everything that populates the narrative. You understand the images and the rhythm, the way language plays against time, and that helps you make choices that deepen a story. But if you work on it every day and then you don't work on it for a week, it's really difficult to re-enter that landscape. It could take you 3 or 4 days just to find your place again. So I was working on so many things at once that I found it laborious to re-enter into any world that I was creating. So often I just gave it up, thinking, well, maybe the story isn't as good as I thought. My writing was everywhere, and as a result, it went nowhere. Well, one day, it was a beautiful day. It was in Modesto, California. It was sunny, cool, and I got on my bicycle, and I took a ride without destination. I rode into a suburban neighborhood, past parks and single-family homes, large lawns and huge trees. It was a beautiful day, and I was feeling good. It was around Father's Day, a holiday my family doesn't really get into. I mean, we occasionally called my father and said, Happy Father's Day, Dad, if he answered, but that was about it. So I passed a church with one of those signboards outside, you know, where they post inspiring messages for the Christian. Things like 7 days without prayer makes one weak, but weak as in feeble. I passed this church before a lot, and I like reading their signboards because sometimes they're clever. Things like, life is cray-cray, Jesus is the way-way, or hell is uncool. Get it? These aren't mine. Or God answers knee-mail. Stuff like that, right? So this day I'm riding my bike, and it's around Father's Day, and I see the light board says, be like your heavenly father, not like your earthly father. Now, my earthly father was, frankly, a brilliant man. He was an inventor, and he thought his ideas would make him rich. He designed a bicycle that pedaled by itself, and he invented a fly catcher. It was shaped like a hat, and flies were attracted to it. They would come inside, and they would die, and all you had to do was empty out the bodies occasionally. So he would come home from work, throw his metal lunchbox on the table, and he would go to the garage and work all evening on his invention until my mother had to urge him to come inside to eat dinner. After eating, he would go in the garage again, and he looked like a crazy inventor, his hair all disheveled, his t-shirt stained with oil. He looked like Doc in Back to the Future. But one day, he would come home from work, but instead of going into the garage to work on his invention, he'd throw his lunchbox on the table, take his shirt off, and go to the couch and fall asleep. And he stayed there all evening until we had to wake him up for dinner. After dinner, he went back to the couch, watched TV, leaving a pile of junk in the garage that used to be his million-dollar idea. Every now and then he would go back to an idea, but he got bored with it. I guess it was difficult for him to re-enter the landscape of an idea, so he quit until another inspiration came, and he worked on that every night until that too became a pile of junk in our garage. He had so many great ideas, but he didn't follow through on a single one. And I realized that's what I was doing as a writer. As disciplined as I was, I would start an idea, work on it every day for several days until one day I didn't feel like working on it anymore, so I started another one. The result was I got a pile of literary junk in the garage of my imagination. be like your heavenly Father, not like your earthly Father. I knew the sign was referring to the Christian image of God, you know, God the Father, God who is faithful to complete a good work in you, who keeps his promises. So that day on my bicycle, I knew what I had to do. I turned the bike around and I pedaled home. I walked down the hallway into my office. I closed the door. And I was determined I would not start on another writing project until I finished a collection of short stories. I worked on it morning and night. When I was done, I put it in the mail and I sent it to my first choice of publishers. And if that didn't work, then I would go down the list to other publishers. So, 6 months later, on my way home from work, I figured I should go buy a big envelope and some paper because I was going to print it out and send it to another publisher. But when I got home, there was a special delivery letter waiting for me. I opened it, and it was a contract for my first book, Chicano Chicanery. And ever since then, I never, ever go on to one book until I'm finished with the next. And I'm not saying everybody should do this. Obviously, a lot of people I know have multiple projects going on at once, but it works for me. And I guess the only real criteria to be a writer is writing. Writers write. And our guest, Jose de Pierolo, writes more than any other writer I know. Stick around. Excited that my guest today is in the studio with me. He is my good friend and colleague, Jose de Pierola. He teaches with us in the MFA in Creative Writing here at the University of Texas, El Paso. He is the author of multiple books, all of them published in Peru, including Fish Taco Slayer, which is a fascinating story, Un Beso del Infierno, Sur y Norte, El Camino de Regreso, and on and on and on. And I urge you to pick up some of his books. He's a fantastic writer, and he deserves to have attention in the United States because his stuff is that good. And Jose de Pierola, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you for having me.
And you are probably one of the most productive writers I know. You teach in our department here at the University of Texas, El Paso, in the Bilingual Creative Writing Program. And I'm looking over your webpage, which is, by the way, josedepierola.com. My God, you have written a lot of books. And your last one, I love the title of this, Fish Taco Slayer?
Fish Taco Slayer, yeah.
That is an interesting title, but it's not probably what we think it means. It's probably not somebody who eats a lot of fish tacos in Baja, is it?
Oh, not necessarily. actually, the title comes from a traditional Andean myth. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that there is a person called the fish taco that's usually around the roads waiting for unsuspecting travelers. And he abducts the travelers and takes the fat out of the body. And with this fat, makes some sort of products.
But it's also a book that can work on two different levels. You can read it as a teenager and get something, and you can read it as an adult and have more of a deeper experience. Did you consciously write a YA novel here?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the challenges for me when I write literature for younger people is to have an adventure, mm-hmm. something that they can follow and really live as an adventure. But at the same time, to give it enough metaphorical meaning and depth so mm-hmm. an adult can also enjoy it. And the figure of the fish taco itself is very metaphorical, mm-hmm. right? Thinking about the Spaniards taking the work out of the native Peruvians, mm-hmm. right? Metaphorically extracting their grease.
Right, right. And that's one of the things I admire about your work is that a lot of it has to do with the issues and the history of Peru itself. You are, I'm going to guess, because I've read some articles, I've seen you in a glossy magazine from Peru. I'm going to guess that you're really one of the most important literary voices in Peru at this point.
Well, that's always very difficult to say, you know, because that changes from year to year. But one thing I've been trying to do consistently in my work is to deal with the two issues that are important to me. One is the inner conflicts within Peru, mm-hmm. Usually social and cultural conflicts. And the other one is the fact that I've lived most of my life displaced or uprooted. So the issues of displacement, immigration, and rootlessness is something that come up in my fiction. And at the beginning, I was not very conscious of that. But over the years, you start realizing that there are some patterns that come back and some patterns that demand from you a fictional exploration.
How long does it take you to write a book?
It is an interesting question because it can be anything from 9 months to 7 years.
Wow.
The book I wrote the fastest, I did in nine months, and the one that took the longest took 7 years.
And which one took 9 months?
Nine months was Shatrang.
Okay, that's the one about the history of chess.
Yes, the invention of chess.
And I would also say that's probably one of your most successful novels, isn't it? One you're known best for?
Yeah, well, the two novels that are often come up are Shatrang when it comes to young readers.
Uh-huh.
And I'll tell you in a second why. And the other one is El Camino de Regreso, mm-hmm. which is also about the civil war in Peru.
Is that the one that took 7 years?
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and in terms of the academic attention, there's more work done on this novel, El Camino de Regreso and Un Beso del Infierno. But in terms of sales and readership, Shatrang is perhaps my bestseller. Mm. And because it is part of this plan in Peru to initiate high school students into reading. Mm. And in Peru it's called Plan Lector, the reading plan, and asks high school students to read about 10 books a year.
Oh,
and
wow.
I was fortunate enough to be in that list.
We both teach in the Bilingual Creative Writing MFA here at UTEP. And I know that sometimes you'll take off to go research. You'll like go research in Paris or go research back in Peru. And it seems like a lot of your stories, a lot of your novels require an intense amount of research. Do you enjoy that process, or is it just something you need to get done in order to start, enjoying the writing process? Or is that part of the writing process?
I believe that is part of the writing process, because when I have an idea, sometimes I don't know where this story is going to go to.
Right.
And in some cases, like Un Beso del Infierno, it was just one sentence I had in my mind. And when I began writing, the process sort of developed on its own.
One
so
sentence?
Speak. Yes.
You had the first sentence.
I had the first sentence, and it just kept coming back and kept coming back. And one day I sat down thinking that it would be a short story,
uh-huh.
and it ended up being a novel.
Wow. You know, that yeah. reminds me of something Borges said, how everybody asks writers, how do you come up with your ideas? Borges says, I don't come up with ideas. I try to eliminate them. And it's the ones that wrestle me to the ground that I start writing about.
I would say that that's the case with probably most writers. Garcia Marquez used to say the same uh-huh. thing, right? That he tried to ignore ideas, and those that were persistent enough became short stories or novels.
Yeah, yeah. I'm talking to José de Pierola, author of how many books? My God, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Eight books?
I think so.
8 books. And certainly one of the most important living writers from Peru. When are you going to have any of these books translated into English so that, readers can access them? Because they're wonderful stories. I mean, it just seems such a shame that they're only in one language.
Yeah,
they
should
be in 10 languages.
I'll be happy to have them translate them into English. But right now, as a challenge to myself, and because last year was a little bit special to me for personal reasons, I sort of began writing a short story collection in English.
Wow.
And right now, I'm in the process of revising it and finishing that short story
That
collection.
Is unusual, isn't it, for
yeah.
somebody to write in two languages, unless you're Beckett?
Well, it's quite a challenge. And I would say that it was very difficult. It's a humbling experience to try to write in a different language.
And how's it going?
Well, I have most of the stories. I need to finish another 3, and the book will be done.
I want to get back to something you said earlier, that you have this first sentence and you kind of follow it. That makes a lot of sense to me, because I think in literary fiction, one of the impulses is not necessarily an idea, but this haunting rhythm or, even a haunting character or a haunting image. But I also know that there's a lot of novelists who do not start writing a book until not only they have the first rhythm, but that they have the exact ending image. Even if they don't know what the image is going to mean, they just know that that it's going to go to that image and down to the exact language. Do you ever have an ending image when you work?
Oh yeah, I mean it depends. I think I have a fairly regular writing process, but how I begin and I finish a novel varies depending on the project.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, for Chatrang, I had an image. The ending of the novel mm-hmm. was an image in my head. And there were a couple of two other images that were connected with the novel. And that's how the novel organized itself in the process of writing. Mm-hmm. But in the case of Un Beso del Infierno, I just had one sentence and nothing more than that.
Wow.
And in the novel that I'm going to start next, I had a series of images that sort of coalesce once in a while in my mind, and they demand to become a story.
Mm.
So they are, mm-hmm. in a way, a basis of a structure for that novel already.
Right. And this new project, is this the one that you've been doing research on for the last, 5-6 years?
It's
been a while.
About 2 years. Yes. It's going to take place in the 18th century in the Andes in Peru.
Uh-huh.
And one of the main challenges with this novel is that it's not only a novel that requires you to do historical and on-site research, but also to do enough research to challenge certain assumptions of received history.
Mm-hmm. You're not only a fantastic fiction writer and hardworking fiction writer. I remember when you first started at the University of Texas here in El Paso, every 6 months we'd get an email that, oh, Jose came out with another book. And I know you're disciplined. I mean, I know you personally, and I know you're one of the most disciplined writers I know. And oftentimes when I think of your discipline, I get a little jealous. I think, damn, I need to work like that. But you're not only a wonderful novelist, but you're also... You really study the craft. You really study technique. You really study form, which makes sense because you're also a fantastic professor. And you not only have these great novels, but you also translated The Art of Fiction by Henry James.
Yes.
Why Henry James? And how did that book come about?
Because when I started studying craft and when I thought about teaching craft, one of the issues to me was when was the first moment when a writer sat down and start thinking in writing about craft.
Mm-hmm.
And there are no other book more significant than that of Henry James, because Henry James starts a dialogue or follows a dialogue that started Walter Besant, a British writer, who also gave a talk with the same name.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Walter Besant, and then you have Henry James. And then Stevenson also joined that conversation.
Robert Louis?
Yes. So that is the first time at the end of the 19th century when writers begin thinking about the issue.
Hmm.
And it makes sense because the novel becomes what we know now in the 19th century.
And this El Arte de la Ficción, de Henry James, is published also in Peru.
Yes, it is published in Peru. And I was essentially translating it for a Peruvian audience.
Uh-huh.
But I'm using it in some of my classes too.
Oh,
because,
nice.
As you know, we have a bilingual program, and it's good if we have some sources available both in Spanish and English.
Right, absolutely. In fact, I was teaching a class the other day where there's 12 students, and 6 of them are primarily Spanish speakers. A couple of them don't even speak English very well. And then the other 6 are English speakers, and none of them speak Spanish very well. And so, yeah, it's interesting to choose texts that, you can find both in English and Spanish. But what's really interesting is I understand you're currently working on a project where you're going to translate L'Étranger, the Stranger by Albert Camus, also into Spanish.
Yes. And
how many languages do you know?
Well, probably one. And I try to fake the other two. The issue is that this book I mentioned before, Chatrang, is part of this reading series for high mm-hmm. schoolers in Peru. And one of my concerns was that why we don't have other, to me, more important writers in that list.
Uh-huh.
And every time I asked, they mentioned that there were a number of hurdles like rights and publication costs and so on and so forth. So I had that in my mind for a while. And then one day, about a few years ago, when I was discovering Murakami, I bought a few books in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And in the plane, on my way back, I was reading Murakami in Spanish. And there was something that didn't quite work for me.
Hmm.
And I couldn't put my finger on it. And then in the U.S., I bought the same book in English, and I loved it. So when I went back to the book, I realized that it was a translation, because Though the story is set in Tokyo, I had a feeling that it was happening in Madrid, in Spain, because of the turns of phrases and the terms they use.
Uh-huh.
So that, again, is staying in my mind. And then, as you know, the 100th anniversary of Le Camus' birth was a year ago. And talking with a friend, an ex-MFA student in our program, Cesar Silva Santiseven.
I remember him.
We said, why not translate The Stranger, L'étranger, to make it part of this reading series in Peru. So that was the challenge, and we started working on it. And it's been a really humbling experience, too. On the one hand, show me how little I know, how little French I know.
Mm-hmm.
But also gave me an interesting, in-depth view of that novel that impacted me so much when I was in high school.
Yeah, yeah. I read that in French. My French isn't very good either, but I remember reading that. And I think if I recall correctly, the first line is, "Aujourd'hui, maman est mort," or something like that, right? Today,
yeah,
mother
correct.
Died, or mother is dead. Yeah, that's fantastic. And you already have a publisher in Peru for that one.
Yes, yes. It's going to come out in July. The translation is finished. Right now, I'm just revising the translation, just trying to fine-tune the version that we want to have. Right?
But, you know, that's such an important novel. The Stranger takes place in Algiers, and the character, who is French, ends up shooting some man on the beach, an Arab man, and he goes to trial and all that stuff. But I would imagine that novel is already available in Spanish. Why did you think it was necessary to make it available again? Is it simply for that publisher?
The two reasons are, one is I wanted a translation that will make the reader feeling that she is going to this other culture.
Nice.
Because a number of translations do the opposite, right? They try to bring the culture to you.
Yeah.
But in this case, I wanted the reader to have that experience of being in this foreign land with this foreign language and a foreign culture.
Wow.
That was quite a challenge. And the other reason is that if I do the translation, I can have the publisher produce the book as cheaply as possible.
Mm.
So it becomes accessible for high school students.
Nice.
So I'm not interested in making money, but rather into making this book really available.
Oh, man, I'd love to see it. One of my favorite moments in all of fiction is from that novel. It's when the man who lives in the building and that dog with the dog and the man Salamano. And the dog, they hate each other. And they're always like, growling at each other. But then the dog disappears one day. And the man, he's looking out the window and he says, I hope the dogs don't bark tonight because I always think it's mine.
Exactly.
And just such a beautiful line, just gives me chills. I love that.
Exactly. And the novel, it's really interesting because the writing of the novel is very sparse, laconic, and sometimes it's even a little awkward.
Mm-hmm.
Because it has to reflect the state of mind of the main character, Mel Sol.
Right.
But there are moments in which there's this poetry that...
it's when he's in jail.
When he's in jail.
Yeah.
Or,
I love that part because the language just really just starts to speed up and gets rhythmic because before then it's really kind of very subject-verb-y almost.
Yeah, almost. I mean, there are moments of poetry too in the first part.
Right.
And one of the parts I like a lot and what's difficult to translate is the end of the first part, right? When he says he has shot already the Arab and he says, c'était comme quatre coups bref que j'ai frappé sur la porte du malheur. And he has shot four times the Arab. Mm-hmm. And the words Camus uses, quatre coup, bref, frappe, mimic that sound, the four shots.
Nice,
right?
Nice.
So how do you do that in Spanish?
Right.
And so we work hard on that. And it's not as good as Camus, but we came out with fueron cuatro breves golpes que batí en la puerta de la infelicidad.
Nice.
Cuatro breves golpes que batí.
That's wonderful. It must have been a fun project.
Oh, it's a wonderful project. And again, it's really challenging because my French was very limited at the beginning and probably continues to be in right now. But we're done with the translation, which is
that's great.
A satisfaction already.
You're one of the writers that I know that before you start working on a book, you already know you have a publisher. And that must be an incredibly liberating thing to know, because I know like a lot of writers, they work on a book for like years and they have no idea if they're ever even going to get it published. And so they make perhaps some aesthetic choices that that they perceive editors will want. Whereas if you have a publisher, it seems that there's a little bit more liberty in making choices. Do you find that that's true?
Well, that's true at a certain extent. And for about 7 or 8 years, I had a publisher, the same publisher in Peru. And some of the books like Shatrang or Pishtago Slayer came because of the publisher wanted a book for this particular series. So that, in a way, conditions what you want to do and the projects you want to tackle. But right now, I have no publisher because they stopped publishing fiction. So they left me in a very interesting position because now I can go back to tackle the projects I really want.
Nice.
Of course, I'm going to start looking for a publisher soon. All right. But the projects are guiding me now, not necessarily the publisher.
So it's almost the other way around. The liberation now because you don't have to worry about the publisher.
Exactly. And that's why, for the first time, I tackle the challenge of writing a short story collection in English.
Nice.
Right, like I couldn't do before because my publisher, of course, demanded me books in Spanish.
Where can people find copies of your books? Currently, they're all in Spanish, but where might people be able to find? Is there a webpage that they can buy them off?
Yes, Norma, the publisher.
Oh, okay.
Norma.com.
Norma.com.
Yeah, they sell the books.
Jose, thank you for joining us for Words on a Wire. I can't wait for your English language collection of stories. That's going to be awesome. And we'll get you on the show and we'll spend a whole show talking about that.
Excellent. Thank you. And thank you for having me.
In honor of my guest, a Peruvian writer very well known in his country, I am going to read a poem for Poem of the Week by a Peruvian writer also very well known, by the name of Cesar Vallejo. He was also known as the Cholo. And he was from Peru, but he lived a large part of his life in Paris. And this poem is called Blackstone on Top of a White Stone. And I'm going to read the English version. I shall die in Paris in a rainstorm on a day I already remember. I shall die in Paris. It does not bother me. Doubtless on a Thursday, like today, in autumn. It shall be a Thursday, because today, Thursday, as I put down these lines, I have set my shoulders to the evil. Never like today have I turned and headed my whole journey to the ways where I am alone. Cesar Vallejo is dead. They struck him, all of them, though he did nothing to them. They hit him hard with a stick and hard also with the end of a rope. Witnesses are the Thursdays, the shoulder bones, the loneliness, the rain, and the roads. That was Blackstone on Top of a White Stone by Cesar Vallejo, El Cholo. He's kind of depressing, isn't he? And yeah, it's a bit depressing, but sometimes writers, we go into dark places that nobody else wants to go. But nonetheless, we write. Writers write. And if you'll excuse me, I'm going to leave and go home and write. I'm Daniel Chacon. Thank you for joining me for another edition of Words on a Wire. Thank you, Jose de Pierola, for talking to us and coming into the studio. And don't forget, the next book you read may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see. And the wire seems to be